Mr. Jan Lundberg from California. How you doing, Jan?
Okay, Matt. It's great to be on with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on there. And so I didn't have too much of a chance to really introduce you and what you're all about, although I did talk a little bit about culture change very briefly. So just to begin, I like having people introduce themselves, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you're up to down in California. And I know you used to be an oil industry analyst, and now you're more of an activist and a writer.
That's right. Actually, I started out as an activist, and I joined a family firm on oil industry information, and I reluctantly put my environmental activism aside. I had been active in the anti-war movement before that. This is all, you know, late 60s, early 70s. And the family firm looked at oil industry information, market research mostly, and eventually we gained a lot of credibility for accurately predicting the second oil shock in 1979. And meanwhile, I had been looking at the data and wondering, where is all this oil coming from, and how can it just keep spewing out to be burned and spilled? And so I got my answer finally after I left the industry and went into environmental activism again in 1988. A book called Beyond Oil, The Threat to Food and Fuel in the Coming Decades came out in 1986. It was an econometric model that also looked at alternative energy and how oil is used for so many things. And it talked about Hubbert's peak of oil extraction for the nation and globally. And so I knew that oil's days were numbered. And our activism for the Environmental Institute I started had to do with transportation mainly. The idea was that passenger rail was the most energy-efficient motorized transportation, and one person per car is the worst. So we wanted to stop new road construction to boost Amtrak. That was how we started out, but we had been vaguely trying to promote what we called the conservation revolution, and when the Gulf War came along, we thought, well, we haven't had much of an impact, and this country isn't conserving energy at all. So how about our little project, Alliance for a Paving Moratorium? That became our whole reason for being, and we cast the Gulf War as a war for oil, whereby the United States was foolishly extending its oil supply lines by building roads. Because if oil is a strategic commodity, you don't extend your supply lines. So this, you know, allows you to talk about energy security and so forth. So the environmental group became more and more activist-oriented to stop logging roads as well, to prevent clear-cutting of ancient forests. And we learned a lot about land use and other aspects of petroleum, such as food growing. And so we had projects in Humboldt County to bring food from farms to farmers markets via pedal power produce. That means carts and trailers attached to bikes. And this kind of activism and publishing the Auto Free Times magazine went on for several years. And in 2001, we changed the magazine to Culture Change. And that's what remains of the group now. Basically, the Culture Change website and a couple of projects such as fighting plastics and working to make peak oil a household word.
Maybe can you talk a little bit about the whole idea of maybe start off with talking about this techno fix and like the idea of substitutions as a savior, and then perhaps I'd like to hear more about your thoughts on this cultural shift that we need so direly.
Yes, well, the culture that we have all around us that dominates everything from the economy to our daily habits is a technoculture. This idea of manufacturing things for short-term use, for our convenience, which we place on a pedestal of progress, the god of religion, of science, this kind of lifestyle, environment, and way of thinking has resulted in the most unprecedented loss of biodiversity, species extinction, since humanity's been around. And with the kind of economic stranglehold on our decisions and how we try to live and better ourselves, we're up against a very strong, unforgiving economy and culture and government, all built on turning the earth into a refuse pile. So with accelerated entropy and paving over the best land and using up living resources as if there's no tomorrow, we have a dream of continuing the consumer fantasy land of wealth for everybody. It doesn't work out that way, and most people are struggling. But we have this consumer culture that says you can keep building roads and building more houses and having human population growth and using more oil, and they will think of something. They being scientists and corporations and government, that will allow us to substitute for petroleum and its many products and keep the game going. But we found in all our research in all those years with our Energy Institute that there is no substitute for petroleum in the full sense, not only because petroleum has so much energy packed into it compared to most forms of energy, but that it's such a flexible substance and so many things are made out of it. So we have a petroleum infrastructure, and you can't just take another energy form and say, oh, that'll be the way we'll do everything from now on. So there's not going to be a solar economy. There's not going to be a hydrogen economy. And that principle has to do with how much energy can be obtained from a given process, the energy production ratio. If you're putting in too much energy to get your energy out, then it doesn't make sense. And oil enjoyed a very high energy production ratio several decades ago, and it's going way, way down fast. And the price of energy is really hidden. The price of oil that we read about, $60 a barrel, is really only a small part of the whole cost of oil, because it's built into everything we buy, the taxes we pay, products, free parking, which isn't free.
Yeah, it is everywhere. And it's becoming more and more clear that we need more than just reforms and shifts of policy, although they are important, but we need a shift in our way of relating in our culture. And you've written quite a bit about that, and I wonder, like, how do we bring about a cultural shift, and what would that really look like to you?
Well, it seems that bringing about a cultural shift is really within our grasp, our capabilities, because we're doing things day to day that involve using up non-renewable resources. And if we're relating to our families, if we're making decisions on where to live, all these things ultimately affect the culture just as they reflect the culture. So if we have a time of global warming and war for oil and struggling to make ends meet, and someone proposes that buying a car might be a good idea, well, We have several things to point out there, that it would be a huge waste of money, very polluting. You know, one would be trading in the possibility of getting any exercise, and it's a very unhealthy, unsafe way to live by the car. But an essential statistic for all car drivers is this. The average speed of the North American motorist is only 5 miles per hour. That's because you have to take into account the all the time involved in having to earn money to pay for the car, the gasoline, the insurance, the repairs, and there's some other costs and time involved in that. Because you know, when you're walking to the car in a parking lot, you're not going 60 miles an hour. You're spending time, but you have to take into account all that time versus how many miles you actually go. So no car driver is going on average more than 5 miles per hour. But you have people saying, oh, I'm in a hurry. I've got to have my car, even though you've just explained to them that they're not going more than 5 miles an hour.
I think Henry.
So, you know, it's an illusion of speed and convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And people
mm-hmm.
don't want their illusions burst.
Mm-hmm.
So they will have their illusions burst the hard way, and that's going to be the effects of peak oil. It's going to be like a tsunami of socioeconomic upheaval and die-off of an overpopulation that is completely hooked on petroleum for its food and transportation and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering, like, you're down in California, and I know that there are lots of innovative people working quite hard to develop new ways of living, and I'm curious to know, like, what kind of shifts in culturally and in communities are you being inspired by currently, and do you have any stories perhaps to share with us up here in Ontario?
Well, I don't want to mislead with any false optimism.
Yeah, false hopes aren't very helpful at all.
But in May, before I came to stay where I'm staying now, I stayed in three different cooperative housing situations, three different kinds of arrangements. One was co-housing, another one was a nonprofit corporation, another one was a community land trust. And it really struck me as amazing that people want to participate in the typical mortgage game or paying rent, whereby they pay so much for housing and they're susceptible to the housing bubble, speculation, and rising prices and losing homes. But it is so much cheaper and safer to get into one of these lower-cost situations and creating more community as we take care of one another, watch out for each other, and share costs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
so that's one area that... we write about in the Culture Change letter at culturechange.org. But if you want to look at other kinds of alternative living, what most people try to do is to get back to the land, or else they talk about it. And I'm actually a few blocks now from where the Back to the Land movement started, People's Park, which was the scene of a demonstration to prevent it being paved over by the university back in 1969, and it was a long struggle. It is now a very nice wooded and vegetable-growing park with, you know, community events and Food Not Bombs serves people there, good vegan organic food most of the time. And it is an example of what cities can and must do to deal with the petroleum shortage, because lifestyle isn't that important, Matt, when we're talking about is the food going to be coming in to the community when the trucks don't have petroleum. So growing the food locally, that's the real cultural shift. And depaving the land that was stupidly harmed and covered over by asphalt, a petroleum product, that's going to be a big job for us.
Mm-hmm.
Lawns are useless They need to be used for food growing, but primarily you have the same culture right where I am as
yeah.
where you are.
Yeah.
It's a consumer culture.
Mm-hmm.
There are only small differences.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured that much. Here we're quite immersed in the consumer culture in Southern Ontario. I don't know. There's a few community gardens. Or there's one that I know of in Guelph. I hear there's another one, but we're working on it. And that People's Park, is it used? Like, can anyone plant any food they want there, or is there a certain group? Yeah.
Yeah, on July 4th, I planted some corn and beans, and who knows if it'll come up. And I should go see if the sun is killing off the seedlings.
Mm.
The problem is in most towns that are booming economically and enduring population growth is that there aren't empty lots. There isn't the space to grow the food locally, and that's why it's going to be a tremendous challenge when the effects of peak oil hit us, which they could well do this year or next year or sometime very soon.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Havana, Cuba, they have thousands of small community gardens for the city of 2 million people, and a third of their food needs are met by this local urban farming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they lost their petroleum from the Soviet Union 15 years ago, and they had to get on bikes and start organic gardening and use more solar power.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people mention Havana as quite an inspiration to them. And it's good to see like a working example of what can be done without oil. I wonder if I'd like to talk a bit more about, the recent article of preparations and policies for petro-collapse, but I wonder if you want to maybe play a song first. I didn't know until we just started talking that you're in a music group called the Depavers.
Well, I wish the Depavers were still together, but
okay. I see.
Call me Depaver Jan. I'd be very honored if you'd play away.
Yeah, I have. Well, I downloaded 4 songs here. What was it? Green is... What is that one called?
Green is the Shelter?
Yeah, Green is the Shelter. I got The Daughter Spring, Global Warming Day, and Human DA. Any recommendations?
Well, it depends what you're interested in. My daughter that sings with me on 2 or 3 of those was involved in a federal lawsuit against the police who had tortured protesters with Q-tips dipped in pepper spray as the protesters were locked down in a sit-in to try to save the ancient redwood trees. And Daughter Spring is about that event, and Green is Your Shelter was written for her when she was tree-sitting in Headwaters Forest in Redwood Country.
Mm-hmm.
Humane DA is about the district attorney of Humboldt County who sued the timber beast for fraud. And Have a Global Warming Day is something I wrote for the Kyoto UN climate change meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So as to make a point with music rather than just more pieces of paper.
Mm-hmm. I think that we're in the middle of a drought and a heat wave right now in Guelph, and we're breaking record highs. It's only rained about 3 times this whole summer. So I think Have a Global Warming Day is pretty fitting.
It often is these days for some reason.
It's not a coincidence. Okay, well, so I'm going to play a song called Have a Global Warming Day, and me and Jan will be right back in about 2.5 minutes. Enjoy.
Have a global warming day. Have a global warming day. Have a global warming day. My Masu masu tsui ne. Masu masu tsui ne. Masu masu tsui ne. Watch the ice caps melt away. Have a global warming day. Masu masu tsui ne. Have a global warming day.
Called Have a Global Warming Day, and we're back on the air.
It's great to be back. Mm-hmm. I want to say that when I was recording that song, I left the lyrics at home, and I discovered later I had left out the line, "Watch the forests burn away." And we've seen a bit of that, and global warming certainly does pose such problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. I think I don't know about what's going on this summer, but the two summers previous, there have been hundreds of simultaneous forest fires in British Columbia, like unprecedented number of forest fires going on.
Yeah, that's not supposed to happen in rainforests.
So I wonder if we could talk a bit about what's going on. Like, most people know about peak oil, and anyone who's really thinking about it knows that there's tremendous implications for both like a strong, perhaps positive reconnection with nature, as well as immensely negative implications as well. And it could go a lot of different ways, and I think it probably will go a lot of different ways. I wonder if you can talk about what different cities are doing that you know to basically prepare or counter this.
Well, I don't think that a lot is being done, and I can only point to a few things going on that I'm aware of. Now, there are, peak oil conferences happening, and I'm speaking at some of them in September. I was just invited to speak at a congressman's peak oil energy conference later this month near Washington, D.C. That's very positive. Washington, D.C. just had a morning talk show debate about peak oil today. And yesterday in the New York Times, there was a big story about the energy crisis not being not being of much concern to the average person. That was the gist of it. But they talked about peak oil. When we talk about what cities are actually doing, the one that comes to mind is Ottawa has a conference called Crude Awakening in November. And also the city of Berkeley might be getting something going here in Northern California. That's where I live, and I'm going to meet with the mayor soon and see if we can get some interest happening in preparing for peak in oil supplies, which may be about now, and the resultant collapse of cheap and abundant energy and what that will mean to us.
Mm-hmm. What kind of stuff do you think is possible to work with the city of Berkeley, like on that level of creating change?
Well, I'm not sure. When I look around and I wonder where the food is going to come from, that is a big problem. The best land has been paved over, despoiled, polluted. The fish in the streams and the oceans are really not there in the numbers they used to be. And so are we going to be feeding people with food that comes on the average of 1,500 miles in this country? Well, it's not going to be possible with petroleum being in short supply. The thing to understand about the oil shock is that it isn't just that we reach this high point of petroleum extraction that we'll never reach again. That seems like that's fine. But the problem is the market will react tremendously to the perceived gap between supply and demand, and this is going to send prices through the roof and create a virtual complete shortage. And you'll have various effects to that. People won't be able to run businesses or ship goods or get to jobs or run hot water or appliances in their homes. And the trucks won't be pulling into Walmart and Safeway. So these are tremendous concerns, and the city of Berkeley is just as backward and vulnerable as any town in this continent.
Mm-hmm. And are you working with people from Global Public Media at all? Because I know they're creating a concept called post-carbon outposts, where they're trying to get communities to look at these things and organize between different communities.
Yes, there is actually an outpost here. It's called East Bay Post Carbon Solutions Group.
Mm-hmm.
And they're holding a public picnic on July 17th, I believe it is, in Oakland, California, right next door to Berkeley. And that part of Post Carbon Institute is promoting the concept of relocalization, they call it, and participating in media interviews and other events and
mm-hmm.
having speakers come. Global Public Media is based in Vancouver, and there's a very talented energy expert there named Julian Darley,
mm-hmm.
who runs that and the associated Post Carbon Institute. And they have a man in Emeryville, which is in a neighboring area of the East Bay of San Francisco area here, named David Room. And he is a talented organizer and networker and writer regarding peak oil issues.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, can you talk a bit more about what's going on in Ottawa in November?
Well, I don't know a lot about it, but I was
mm-hmm.
impressed that the topics being dealt with and the workshop titles seem to be real nuts and bolts preparation
mm-hmm.
and inquiry areas such as food production, transportation, things like this. And so it's called Crude Awakening on November 19th. The city is sponsoring it. I've been invited to come and speak there. I haven't heard much about it lately, so I hope it's, still happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I might check that out. And there's one more question that's a bit not quite, well, it's very much to do with the topics, but not quite a typical question. But I was wondering, how do you, when considering the state of our climate and the coming shifts ahead, how do you deal with it? How do you stay positive, and how do you feel yourself?
Well, that does come up every day, because it's hard to just struggle along and try to live a different value system when all around you, you only have the emphasis on money and this oblivion to, you know, the natural world. So while we are aware of peak oil becoming more and more topical and well known, and that just about everybody knows, even George Bush has admitted it, that humans are changing the climate, and that climate change is a very serious issue. One has to look at the rise in consciousness and the deterioration of the environment and of the prospect for worse economic collapse the longer growth goes on, and just try to get through each day and do something about one's own vulnerability to energy, and try to improve community in one's own life, and have a creative outlet. And I know you're a songwriter as well, and so it gives you a little outlet and solidarity with others when you can get with some other musicians and get people together and work for cultural change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really, really important. It's easy to get become burnt out and depressed, but it's a lot more fun to enjoy what we're doing each day.
Yes, and although it can be really discouraging to, you know, look what's going on in the news and read between the lines and do one's best by not having a car, maximizing conservation and such, it has to, you know, make it for you personally, and you have to feel that you're doing something to deprive the global corporate economy of more profits. So there are many ways of acting and not participating as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very true, very true. So I think we should call it a day, or I'll call an end to this interview for now. I guess you got to go. And I think I might play a song of yours, Green is Shelter.
Well, thank you.
To kind of close things off.
It's such a pleasure having this interview with you. And if people want to ask me any questions or whatever, just write to me through culturechange.org and use the email.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on the air, Jen. Much
appreciated. My pleasure, Matt.
Thanks a lot. Okay, have a great day.
You too.
Okay, bye.